Welcome to Fortress on a Hill. I'm Henry.
I'm Danny.
I'm Kagan.
We're three leftist veterans that aim to expose the reality of the U.S. military's multiple wars abroad and to illuminate the damage military service does to Americans.
American presidents throughout U.S. history have used American military and diplomatic power to force regime change of democratically elected governments around the world.
Most veterans come from families vested in prior service, and American generals choose their own, ensuring diversity of thought never interferes with American warmongering.
How can we stand by and do nothing while our military kills and destroys lives the world over, while telling Americans that all this death and destruction protects them from terrorists, when nothing could be more false?
Fortress on a Hill aims to change that.
All right, Fortress on a Hill listeners, we are back. Took a very short break. We've had some incredible guests, as you all have noted, throughout the pandemic, maybe because people are home and doing a lot of Zoom. Throughout all the tragedy, we've had some incredible guests to weigh in on what have been pretty profound times. And we're not disappointing today. In fact, with the new Eisenhower Media Network that we've been talking about on the pod, starting with Ben Cohen a couple of months ago on his sailboat on Lake Champlain. If anyone was able to hear him, more power to you. I promise Henry did his best. But it lent authenticity to the Ben Cohen experience. But, you know, starting with that, we've been talking a little bit about EMN, which I'll be directing and what it's going to be about. And one of the things we're going to be doing in sort of an informal series is having some of the frankly incredible array of senior fellows that have signed on the initial 12 that we're going to launch with, which we're just about done solidifying, call them the 12 apostles of anti-militarism, perhaps. But the first guest who has not been on the pod, you know, we've had Larry Wilkerson on before, and of course, he'll be one of the lead members. But today we have Special Agent retired Colleen Rowley, who I had the absolute pleasure to appear with in Iowa. I don't even remember. Colleen, when was that? When were we in Iowa? That was forever ago. It was before the pandemic.
Yeah, it was Veterans Day or Armistice Day last year.
That's right.
And it also actually coincided with the coldest. We set records for cold. It was freezing below zero wind chills on Veterans Day last year in Iowa City.
That's right. It was my first time in Iowa City. I totally enjoyed it. I thought it was a great city. It was freezing. And I remember, you know, just having a great event. And for those of you who don't already know, you know, Colleen is a retired FBI special agent, former Minneapolis Division legal counsel. She taught constitutional law enforcement ethics to FBI agents, to other law enforcement officials. She then became a whistleblower about the FBI's pre-9/11 failures, testifying to the Joint Intelligence Committee inquiry, the Senate Judiciary Committee, and the Inspector General staff of the Department of Justice. And much of this was in the wake of 9/11, as well as sort of around the Iraq War. And in 2003 or 2002, she was named, along with two other corporate whistleblowers, as Time Magazine's 2002 Persons of the Year, which is obviously a pretty incredible honor. In early March 2003, a fateful month, obviously, with the Iraq invasion, she warned FBI Director Robert Mueller, who has, of course, jumped right back into the spotlight surrounding the Trump impeachment. She warned him of further problems, including going along with the Bush administration's now utterly proven, obvious at the time, so many of us missed it, the deceptive plan to launch, you know, that war, which would become probably the most counterproductive war in modern American history, a country that had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks. Colleen is, you know, has scholarship and degrees and all the bona fides that anyone could want. She has a bachelor's in French, has done some tours in France as part of her professional career, as well as a law degree at the University of Iowa. And her work, her writing, in addition to the speaking and appearances, has appeared in the New York Times, the LA Times, The Guardian, and CNN.com. And we at EMN are super happy to have her as a senior fellow. I'm just, you know, completely honored that I've gotten to appear with her once. I have a feeling we're going to do a lot more of it, Colleen. And, you know, here on the pod, we're glad to finally have you on. So just thanks so much for appearing.
Well, I'm really honored that you invited me along with these other really so credible voices. I know Larry Wilkerson pretty well, and I know a couple of the others as well. And I'm just ever in awe of you for having the energy and multitasking all the time with all the things you're putting out. I wish we could clone you and Larry Wilkerson and some others and amplify it so that we could make more of a dent in the public opinion, because obviously we are up against one big, information war machine, the type of thing that Eisenhower actually warned about. And it is frustrating because it's so darn hard to have an impact. And yet at the same time, I'm inspired that finally there are more, you know, there are voices like yourself, kind of like, you know, the whistleblower phenomenon that we're seeing. We're seeing, even though they're prosecuting Assange and of course prosecuted Manning and put people in jail, they're trying to stop this, desperately trying to stop people from telling the truth. But it's inspiring that there are more people actually that are still telling the truth about things. And I'm kind of in the middle now, because I've kind of been very frustrated in the past 20 years. You know, it's been a frustrating thing to see, as Cassandra, you know, that old myth, Cassandra, to warn about something. And I literally, if I started counting, I think there's at least a dozen things that I was ahead of the curve. And I warned, you know, this is wrong, this is bad, it's going to backfire. And then you're doomed. Nobody really listens or cares or doesn't understand, or the war machine just continues to plow on. And then you're doomed to see the worst happen. You know, a year, 2 years later, the exact same thing that you warned about happens. And I can't tell you how frustrating that is. I mean, it's the saddest thing in the world. And especially when you do have children and grandchildren who have to face the music for the next long, you know, the next long term here. It's frustrating at the very least, but I'm willing to try to jump in and do what I can about some of these issues.
Well, what you said is, it's so powerful and it's daunting. There are certainly dark times in this, you know, vague broad tent movement that we're kind of all a bit of a part of. It comes in such fits and starts, and it's, you know, the progression is not as linear as the history books tell us. And what you said about children and grandchildren, today is AJ, Alexander James Michael, my first son. He's 12 today. And he's doing school as I record this online, which is already a bizarre COVID situation. And he's named after, you know, three of my soldiers who were killed in Iraq. That's how we named him. And we watched Oliver Stone's Platoon together about 2 months ago when I was starting to do some of these projects with Oliver. And, you know, I think what was striking to me was that the movie did affect him. He was finally kind of old enough to get some of it. And we were talking about Elias and the different characters. And it struck me that, you know, that was now 55-ish years ago that, you know, that movie takes place. And I'm still having to sort of show this to my son, and it's sort of unabated. So it's a difficult journey, but what else are we going to do, right? And so I'm just so thankful that after everything you've been through and how long you've been fighting this, that you're willing to contribute, which kind of leads me to my first question. You know, I'm sure that you get it so many times. I know that the question that I usually get on like every first appearance on a podcast or radio or whatever is always the same. And it's basically some vague version of, Danny, how did you become you? You know, like, why did you become this anti-war sort of progressive style activist when you were like good on paper? But I think the reason I particularly want to ask you to give us your general journey is because some listeners might not know, but also something you had said in your intro just then, which is that you predicted at least, you know, half a dozen things that came true. And one of the things that strikes me that makes me admire people like you and a few others is that when I read about 2000, 2001, 2002, 2003, I'm blown away by how obvious in some ways a lot of these lies and deceits ought to have been, and yet how many, including myself to a large degree, were completely hook, line, and sinker. You know, we didn't know any better. We should, you know, but in a way, it feels like the good Germans later saying, oh, we didn't know about these crimes. And so I was hoping that you could kind of tell the, you know, the listeners just a little bit of your story at whatever length you're willing, because I think it's incredibly important that we remember that pivotal 2001-03 moment and what we should have seen.
Well, someone just recently asked me about, you know, the so-called quote unquote courage. And I think that term is actually kind of a, you know, it's kind of a vague thing. It can mean a lot of things. And it's also misleading. I've taught law enforcement ethics, and in fact, even had a couple of slides, which were the things that prompted me after 9/11 to say, you know, this completely goes against what we were teaching in law enforcement ethics, which is never to puff or aggrandize or shade or skew the truth, not to ever shade the facts in a prosecution, because you want to convict somebody. You know, the ends justify the means. You know, this was a huge part of law enforcement ethics. And then after 9/11, that just went up in smoke. And there were other things too, that your highest loyalty is to the Constitution, not to your agency, whatever. So I think that critical thinking is a better term than courage. And, you know, some people, maybe there's a little bit of a hardwiredness for this, because even as a little kid, I was challenging. I remember the first time I challenged a teacher was in third grade. And it was because she completely messed up the science lesson and was telling us that when it got dark at night, your pupils got larger. And when the light came out in the daytime, your pupils the opposite. She was saying that your black part of your eye, your pupils would get larger in the daytime and get more slitty and narrow at night. And I raised my hand because I'm looking right at the book. I was looking right at my science book. I raised my hand to my third grade teacher and I said, you're wrong. You know, it's just the opposite. And she would not understand that a third grader would be able to correct her. So we argued at the end of the day, and the buses in the parking lot were held up when school was being dismissed because our class was still in. And I finally said, let's go in the coat room with a flashlight. And we went in the coat room with a flashlight. And sure enough, when you throw a flashlight in somebody's eyes, your pupils get small. And she had to admit she was wrong. Well, that was when I was about 9 years old. And that kind of continued the rest. I have other examples through the rest of my life. So, you know, like you say, you don't argue about something unless, like in my case, I'm looking right at the book and reading it. I mean, it wasn't like I was guessing or anything. And when you know that you're right and you know that a principle is right, then you really do, I'm sorry, you have to go to the mat on some of these things, and especially if they are life and death. You know, it's one thing to argue about the, you know, the color of the drapes or something like that, things that don't matter. But when it's really a life and death matter, and you know, in the FBI, a lot of things are life and death. In fact, I even taught deadly force, the use of deadly force. That's part of the training I had to give. So those things are very, very important. And when you are right about something, you have to be prepared to take a risk, to perhaps to sacrifice yourself. You know, the most egregious example of that right now is Julian Assange. But it goes with the territory. And in my case, when you're in a certain setting, whether it's the military, whether it's an agency, your profession, but it also could be your church, it could be any group at all. You know, it's the tribalism. You're not going to really be able to fully see the truth because it's like a fish in water. Everything that surrounds you is coloring the truth, and you're not going to really be able to see it clearly. Somebody who is outside of that Venn diagram is going to be able to see it a lot more clearly. So typically your whistleblowers are not the people in power, because those people, you know, as George Carlin said, it's a big club and you aren't in it. So that big club of people who are, whether it's a corporation, whether it's a, you know, a government agency, whether it's the military, oftentimes, you know, people below the rank. So the generals, for instance, are all kind of a same mind. Whereas maybe a couple, three ranks below that is where someone can actually see the truth of what's going on. And I think in my case, you know, like all new people, I was exactly like you. I joined the FBI because I had been watching as a little kid. I was always excited about The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and some of these other police shows and, you know, spy shows and that type of thing, just like anybody. And so when you join, you want to, you know, impress the people around you. And so you're going to share their opinions and try to impress them. Oftentimes in an agency, no one from the top has to tell people below what's wanted or needed. You're going to get a second, a sixth sense of that pretty darn quick, because you're going to be trying to get those incentive awards and try to get those feathers in your cap so that you can seek promotion. I mean, all groups function like this. And so at some point, though, there becomes a time when you say, you know what, this is not right. This is absolutely not right. And, you know, I have to do something about it or I won't be me. You know, whether you can actually accomplish something is a whole nother story. But at some point, I think you risk your own I don't know, not the right word is soul, but you risk your own self if you go along too far in some of these terrible situations. And, you know, a lot of people do finally see it. Even Robert McNamara, you know, it took him a long, long time. You know, he's at the end of his life when he finally admits, you know, oh my gosh, you know, this was wrong, quote unquote, it was a fog of war, tries to make some excuses. But for most people, and especially, like I say, when you're not in that controlling group, you end up seeing it. It's just the question of what are you going to do about it? And in the FBI, I started to see some things, you know, long before 9/11, the FBI had those scandals where they were operating top echelon criminals, organized criminals like Whitey Bulger in Boston, but also in the New York office. My own supervisor was operating a top capo in the Colombo family with basically the same types of results as with Whitey Bulger. And everyone knew it and nobody really did anything about it until later. He ended up, they tried to prosecute that my supervisor for operating that guy because he was killing a whole bunch of people. But for a long time, nobody spoke up. And that whole situation where there were no rules in the FBI that prohibited cozy relationships with informants and or with assets or whatever. And so there were no rules about that. There were sex affairs between agents and their informants, which, you know, think about the problems that come from not having any rules about such a thing. And so about 1997, I said, now, what am I going to do about this? Well, I wrote a nice suggestion into our suggestion program. That's all I could think of to do because we had the suggestion program. And it, you know, I kept checking on the suggestion. And in the meantime, the Whitey Bulger thing hit the media. So you would think someone would have said, hey, you know, she's right. We have to have a rule preventing this. And yet 3 years later, my suggestion lapsed for inaction. So there's a good example, and you have to figure out what you can do that's somewhat constructive and that you can, you know, at least, you know, do your best and yet try to have some impact. And it's not easy at all. Eventually, I think a lot of times the media, if we had a decent, objective, investigative media like we're supposed to, a lot of these things would be remedied. And unfortunately, over time, our corporate media has just sided more and more with powers, you know, and cover ups and all this type of thing. You see it over and over. So it's a sad situation. But I, since retiring, you know, then you're freer to write and speak. So after I retired, I tried to run for Congress here. And in 2006, I was the only congressional candidate who went down to Cindy Sheehan's Camp Casey to ask George Bush, what's the noble cause that we had so many people die in Iraq? And so I was like the only, you know, I wasn't really a politician, but I was the only, I probably was trying to be a politician, I guess. But that running for any elective office is just fraught with all kinds of issues and problems. I don't have too much faith anymore in elections per se. So I tried like a whole bunch of things even after retirement. And like I say, up till now, it's been a pretty much a frustrating process to see where we keep sinking lower and lower in the world. You know, we don't have the moral authority after no accountability for torture. I see all my old bosses, people like Robert Mueller, Giuliani, actually, when I worked in New York City, he was the U.S. attorney. I see how easily these people just, Louis Freeh, by the way, a former FBI director who I knew pretty well. I mean, you see how easily they got corrupted, really corrupted by different things, revolving door money and stuff. And it's pretty sad. I don't know. You just have to steel yourself, I think, for a form of sadness and frustration.
You know, Colleen, at the risk, I have two kind of follow-ons that I didn't plan on from some of the things you said, and one of them will risk us going on a tangent, but I can't help myself. You know, growing up in Staten Island, sort of mob lore and the tangential sort of touch of the mafia was a pretty real thing, actually, you know, in the 1990s. And so I was going to ask, I don't know if it's public record, but who the Colombo Capo was that was being, you know, kind of ineffectively or illegally run.
Oh, who was it?
Yeah.
It was a guy named Scarpa.
Scarpa, right, yeah. Yes.
Yep, uh-huh. And there was a war going on. A lot
right.
of the war-
with the Arena faction, right? It was like the Arena faction versus the Persicos,
yep.
correct?
Yep, exactly. When I was in New York City from 1984 to 1990, and this was the period of time where labor racketeering, all four families, not including the Bananos, were divvying up the superstructure jobs all through Manhattan to seven main mob-affiliated construction companies. And then the union, like in the case of the laborers, the capo of the Colombo family was also the district council president of the laborers. And so he was a guy who was coordinating the bids along with the cement companies. I mean, it was a massive thing through the 1980s. And we ended up legally, I have to emphasize, because when we wiretapped and planted microphones on social clubs and even vehicles and telephones, we ended up with 100, usually around 100 pages of probable cause in each of those Title III wiretap applications that went to regular district judges who signed off on them and said, yes, you have probable cause after working for a year and surveilling and all the rest. And so what a vast difference to go from that era of where you actually did investigations, legal investigations, and really pretty successful, because all of the hierarchy of the mob back in about 1986, 87, all got convicted. So those were very successful. And then you go to after 2001, when there's no laws anymore. You just you listen in on everything, you vacuum up everybody's information. It's very ineffective, almost can't begin. Then the FBI starts all these mostly entrapments, kind of coercing people. Right. I mean, you see the vast difference between when we scare people into saying, you know, if we don't protect you, you'll be attacked, you know, anthrax, you know, all the things that are used to scare people. And then when things are done right, and when you actually are coolly, calmly proceeding and using, you know, your critical thinking skills, and you have levels, legal, the rule of law, and these legal restrictions on policing, were, you know, very much in place. We had attorney general guidelines that the FBI could not even infiltrate any group. It was not even, we couldn't do it. I was the teacher. I mean, I was one of the people who would be asked these questions, and it was, we couldn't do it. Now, after Ashcroft almost immediately removed most of the restrictions, the AG restrictions don't even exist. So, I mean, it was day and night. And so it's a, it wasn't hard for people. I just always wonder why there aren't more people from inside government. But I think some of it is because people were hired after 9/11 and they don't even know what it was like beforehand.
Right. Yeah, that's an interesting sort of bureaucratic issue where when the rank and file or even the mid-level leaders came into these agencies or the military, in my case, after 9/11, they don't even have a frame of reference for, you know, the right way or the old way or the pre-Patriot Act way. And I think that that's sort of very interesting. I mean, there's a lot of talk of that within the military, but it usually focuses on the whole, oh, we don't know how to fight a big war with Russia thing, which I think misses the broader point, which is that, you know, we don't know how not to be at war. We don't know how not to assume that our lives are going to be just forever expeditionary deployments. And I imagine that within the intelligence community, you saw that with everyone who came in post 9/11, even though you had left soon after. I imagine that you must have maintained some contact and kept the pulse to a certain extent of how the intelligence community has changed. Would that be fairly accurate?
Yes. I was not able to really remain in much contact with anybody still in, but of course, all you have to do is read the papers. And I was in for 2+ years. You know, I was lucky, one of the very few people lucky who was a whistleblower on 9/11 and still was able to keep my job and make it to retirement. Like you, I guess we're both in that situation, you know, really lucky, yeah, in a way.
The lucky ones, yeah.
Yeah, and very few people are able to do that. And especially when I spoke out that second time, which was even more disastrous for my career, I really was lucky in that last year. I just had to accept every terrible assignment that nobody would do the last year in order to try to ingratiate myself and continue to make it to retirement. But so I did have a couple of years. I didn't exactly know that torture was going on, but Ali Soufan spoke to our office once and, you know, was really close to describing what was going on. And then there were a couple other times where I got a little clue that, you know, what was going on, that they were torturing people. Some of it came from hindsight more than at the time. I'd see people whispering as I walked by. And then in hindsight, I realized that they were reading these teletypes about torturing Zubaida. I think they probably were reading things like that. And then all of a sudden, when they saw me walking down the hall, they'd lower their voice. So there were things that I knew before I retired. And I certainly knew that there was, these tips were coming in. They call it the wall between national security, which is a way around the Fourth Amendment, the law that says we have a right against unreasonable searches and seizures. So that was always strictly followed. But then all of a sudden, when the wall came down, then we went back to J. Edgar Hoover. Hoover used all of that national security pretext, along with the House Un-American activities, to do all this, what we now think of as illegal wiretapping and investigation, putting microphones in Martin Luther King's hotel rooms, spying on Einstein. I mean, back in the 1950s, before Einstein died, with an 1,800-page FBI file, and Hoover considered him the top enemy of the country. He was getting most of the information on Einstein from the Nazis, from Nazi sources. Unbelievable. So all of that era that everybody, you know, always thought of as being bad, you know, we'll never go back to doing that. Once you drop the wall between national security and intelligence, and now Mueller and all of his successors have said, that's the FBI's main goal. The main goal is not criminal investigation anymore. It's intelligence gathering and foreign policy and whatever. So they went right back to that Hoover era. And that I knew that was happening. In fact, I was the first person, I don't know if I was the first, but when I wrote my memo in June of 2002, I wrote this 11-page thing, and I got to where I was using the term global war on terrorism or something like that. I think it was the war on terrorism. And when I got to it, something in the back of my head told me to put it in quotes. I was like the first person who was like, I'm a little skeptical about this. And I put the war on terror in quotes. And that was way back when it was just first starting, June of 2002.
That's so interesting. You know, oh man, we could talk the entire time. Just one last sort of diversion on this. I get, you know, I use the podcast in many ways, as Henry knows, to just like work out ideas that eventually become, you know, columns and stuff. And, you know, hearing you talk about some of the organized crime stuff you've done and hearing you talk about the sort of bureaucratic problems when national security became, or foreign policy, national security became the sort of focus of the FBI, somewhat inappropriately, although it had been that before. It struck me, you know, I'm imagining you may have watched The Wire when that HBO show came out, you know, in 2002, which was kind of around the same time that you were going through a lot of this. There's the, you know, scene in the first season where the Baltimore police officer, the main character, Jimmy, is talking to his friend who he works with unofficially in the FBI, and they're finishing up this great drug case, you know, this really great, important case. And Jimmy asked him, are you going to be doing more cases like this? So, you know, are you going to take this further and run it up the pole to the Dominican faction in New York? And he says, well, no, the problem is they're not named Muhammad. So I can't get any funds or energy or my bosses to be interested. And I just couldn't help but think of that when you were mentioning the way things changed, the way that the wall came down. That just really fascinated me.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we always had new directors and new bosses that would come in, and they would have new priorities. We called it flavor of the day. And so people maybe don't know this, but in August of 2001, Ashcroft made international terrorism his lowest priority. So a month before the 9/11 attacks, terrorism was a low, low priority. He made violent crime his top priority. And the reason was, you know, people, all these bosses, these directors come in with pre-agendas. So his prior agenda was to reinstate the death penalty. He really was big on wanting to get more death penalty prosecutions. And he thought that making violent crime the top priority would be the mechanism to restore a more, you know, invigorated death penalty. So it's amazing. People say, oh, well, he had to do that on purpose. You know, no, he just had a prior agenda. Condi Rice's prior agenda before she comes in is not terrorism. Same thing. Her agenda is to take down the anti-ballistic missile defense and to make Russia, you know, to make it more of the enemy, et cetera. Because why? That was her prior expertise. And I'm sure Larry Wilkerson will verify that. He said, you know, I think he's said the same thing. Her prior raison d'etre was counting. She makes a joke about counting the warheads or something like that, the missiles that could fit on a warhead in one of the documentaries. So all of these people with their prior agendas, and then when they do that, the people in under them, again, like I said, we're kind of in these tribalistic Venn diagrams, are trying to please the boss. And so these other things, you know, if you're critical thinking, and or you're far enough away where you're not affected as much by this, you know, trying to ingratiate yourself, etc., then you're able to see other things a little more clearer. And, you know, again, that's the sad thing about all of this situation is that people have short memories. They forget who these officials are. They forget their track record and their past track record. When Mueller took on the impeachment, I could not believe how the Democrats put him up on a pedestal. I was at one speaking thing where they were mostly a Democrat liberal audience, and they just could not fathom that any of this Russiagate, you know, the holes and the any kind of facts that undercut the Russiagate. And I said, well, you know, Mueller, he doesn't walk on water. You remember what he did? And same thing with Comey. Comey signed off on torture. And literally, that was only, what, 10 years later, 15 years later. And I couldn't find people that even remembered these are people's track record. It's again, I hate to be so frustrating about it all, but it's kind of a sad thing because people have short memories and they want to, I think a lot of it is people just don't want to know bad things and they prefer to believe more pleasant, you know, reality oftentimes is not a nice, reality is kind of a sad thing. It's got its good and bad, but it oftentimes is things that people would prefer not to know. And so when you do have somebody pointing out these flaws and problems and bad track records and all the rest, it's like people just want to shut their ears.
Well, it is very difficult to maintain a long memory when it seems that a society like ours runs from scandal to scandal and from event to event and obscenity to obscenity. There is, I think, an inclination personally among people to sort of hide their heads in the sand or just not want to deal with it and certainly not remember. I was having coffee with a friend yesterday and we were discussing how in some ways, you know, when folks say that they're, you know, apolitical, whether it's on a dating app or just in life or something, you know, that's a privilege in a sense, because, you know, for many folks, politics is their life. I mean, it really does affect all of us in the sense that this is done in our name. But at the same time, you know, there are folks in poorer communities or in browner communities or overseas that are victims of sometimes the American military machine or its proxies who, you know, they don't have the privilege of being apolitical. And so as we kind of transition to one of the main facets I want to ask you about, it's that in a sense, it feels, and it's always been the case, but it feels like it's really come home amidst COVID. With George Floyd, with Minneapolis, right, and not too far, you know, from your neck of the woods, it seemed to me that, at least in the public eye, that the phenomenon which has always existed historically and conceptually of empires eventually coming home, of empires eventually sort of eating their young and consuming themselves in the domestic sphere, has been laid bare to some extent by police militarization and some of the suppression. And then, of course, some of Donald Trump's rhetoric and that of other folks on his end of the aisle, but not just Republicans. And I was wondering if you had, Henry's got a couple of follow-ons that are a little more specific, but if you had any general thoughts about the what we're seeing in the streets, and of course, it's enlivened again with the Breonna Taylor grand jury, and your own perception of that, not only as an American citizen, a follower of these things, but as someone who worked the straddling the line to some extent between the domestic sphere and intelligence and also sort of the counterterror and foreign sphere. I was wondering if you had just general thoughts on what we're seeing in the streets.
Well, when I wrote the memo in late February of 2003 to try to explain all the reasons why Iraq war was not justified and would prove counterproductive, one of the things, you know, that I tried to use my personal experience. So I used the deadly force policy in the FBI, which where, you know, basically is supposed to be only when you're only supposed to be able to shoot when your life is in danger or an innocent person's life is in danger. And of course, this plays out in a myriad of the simulated scenarios that FBI agents practice and, you know, train on, et cetera. However, when I used that, because I said that deadly force policy is going to change to align more with what the Bush administration is now doing, which is a preventative. So, you know, this whole idea that you're going to stop the threat, that was put in. In my opinion, it's very similar to what was the Nuremberg principle that, you know, the greatest supreme crime is a war of aggression. So if you're trying to sell something by saying you're stopping the threat before it's a threat, Okay, because why? Because you're so omniscient that you know all over what's going to be a threat. Well, the law can't go there because all chaos breaks loose. And that chaos that broke loose with the Iraq war justified in a preventative way, and most of our wars since then have been the same way, that I think is morphed completely back, where now, instead of confronting a threat to your own life, where you have actual tangible facts, like a person is, you know, shooting at you or whatever, or shooting at another person. Now it's like the idea is that you can shoot ahead of time. And I think that, you know, when I wrote that, that was just one little paragraph or so in my memo. And it was the thing that was most attacked internally by other FBI. Oh, Colleen, are you crazy? That would never happen. I had people that said, where in the heck did you get that notion? You know? And of course, not only with the greater willingness to engage in shooting itself, but it's not just the police. It's also the average citizen. Because now, you know, if you look at police shootings, it's not only some of the more rogue types who have never been held accountable, even for beatings and other things. It's not just that. And it's not just racism either. There's also the notion with the two prior shootings in Minnesota were Hispanic Yanez, police officer Yanez, shooting Fernandez. Okay, that was one. And the other one was a black Somalian police officer shooting a white Australian woman. So the reason for those is that the police are really scared. And they're scared because the population is armed. In the 1980s and even 90s, the police chiefs, their groups would warn about these loosening of gun laws. And they would warn that now the police are going to become more, you know, quicker to shoot because they're scared. And so we have now, we've ginned this up. And now the other thing is we have, like I said, the old deadly force policy, I think I was right in my memo. But besides that, the average citizen, so for instance, the mass shooters, and it's been well documented now that, you know, it's not just PTSD, but the whole notion of war zone, the war zone that veterans were in is comes back. So whether they're police officers, some are police officers, but some are just become mass shooters. And so we have these much higher proportion of mass shooters that are veterans in the population. All of these things, these are just a couple of the things where the war has come back. And on top of that, corruption as well, you know, all these empires, when they are seeking to gain control over foreign lands, then internally they rot from the inside. So you see that, of course, with revolving door and all. I mean, people have almost blinded themselves to the corruption, but huge corruption in our government on so many levels that they almost have to close their eyes to a lot of it. You know, the guy that invested in, he got the warnings about coronavirus and he invested, what had happened? He took his investments out of the Wall Street. But I mean, that's common. This notion of using your power in these positions now to benefit yourself. And so the corruption and then the level of violence that has, you know, occurred in foreign lands that people were pretty desensitized to now has just come back. I kind of disagree that most people understand that. I don't think Americans, I say it, but, you know, David Swanson in his writing about the mass shooters, but I don't think people understand that there are costs of war. I honestly think that most of them think, okay, we're killing some foreigners. They don't even think they're killing the vast numbers, the millions that are being killed. They don't see where these costs have come back to hurt us and how the war that we're doing abroad does have costs and that it has come home. I don't think most people do understand that, because I think if they did understand that, things would change. But I think that they compartmentalize. They're able to put, oh, that's foreign policy. And then boom, you know, the wall goes up. Well, that's foreign policy. Don't confuse me with domestic policy. And I think that that's maybe the job. Maybe that'll be some of the task of trying to explain the cost of militarism to Americans, whereby they don't think that, okay, if we're threatened with losing Social Security, for instance, that it, well, our foreign policy has no, there's no connection between the money, the $1 trillion going to the Pentagon every year and us losing our Social Security, us or us losing our infrastructure, roads, you know, all of the things that are less and less funded. Most people, I'm afraid, do not see that. And this is where the Pentagon and the military industrial complex have been very successful in making the costs of war invisible. I think they learned the lessons from Vietnam. And I think in a lot of different ways, they constructed perpetual war so that Americans would not really recognize the cost. And we're practically in a war zone now. And certainly after the election, I mean, people are worried to death about what could happen because people aren't. So many people are mad and they think, you know, the answer is war. They think, you know why? Our leaders have been telling us for 20 years the answer is war. So why shouldn't a white supremacist who thinks he's being cheated out of something or other think, quote unquote, the answer is for me to get my gun and shoot somebody? And the same with the mass shooters. The same with the mass shooters. They get insulted or they get mad about something, even things like I can't get a date. You know, they're mad about things like that. And their answer is, okay, well, I'll just go shoot some people. Every time there's been a mass shooting, our news says, we're trying to figure out the motive. I'm telling you, there's no real motive. Motive kind of means something like most people think it's something that is rational. Like you tried to kill your wife for the insurance money or something like that, that there's actually a rational motive. The mass shootings are not really rational. They're just people who got mad, right, for something or other and then ridiculously decided that shooting more people would be the answer to their problems, to their personal problems. And I think that's what we're in now in the United States. I mean, that sounds a little radical, but I think that is the situation we are living in right now. Even road rage went up, homicides and suicides. And just one more thing to strengthen my argument about this is that I used to tell people when I was arguing against war, I was trying to tell audiences that there were costs. And, you know, most people didn't see the cost too much. And I was trying to argue. I said, well, one thing is terrorism itself, domestic terrorism tends to go up with war. You saw during the Vietnam War, there was shootings and there were bombings even, you know, the different things that happened with the weathermen and different things like that. And when I said the last three kind of major American terrorists, now these were talks way back in 2004, so these were early on. The main three were Timothy McVeigh, John Muhammad, the sniper, and then there was another guy who shot up nurses in some teaching facility out in Arizona, shot a bunch of nurses. All three were Gulf War I vets. All three of these major domestic terrorists in the United States were all Gulf War I vets. And I would say that, and there would be like a hush over the audience. You know, I said, well, that's, you know, this is, it kind of goes with it. And it was like, nobody could fathom it. And I think some of it is they just got this compartmentalization going on in their heads.
The guys and I love doing the podcast. Being able to share our experiences in the military with allies and supporters means the world to us. But we can't do all the work. We need you to share an episode of ours with someone. Anyone whom you like might think might be affected by it. Young people looking to join the military, or parents advocating for one, conscientious citizens who care about the violence the U.S. wages in their name, advocates for women and people of color who understand the harsh environment the military creates for females and minorities and inflicts on minorities around the globe. and anyone else you think it might affect, please take a moment, pause the episode, share this with them. Now, our podcast is supported in a few different ways. First, there's Patreon, where we're blessed to have an array of wonderful supporters helping the guys and I pay for some of the podcast's expenses. Those who contribute $10 a month or more will be mentioned right here as an honorary producer, helping keep you, our listeners, stocked with new episodes. But you don't have to contribute $10 a month to help us. For as little as a dollar a month, you can keep us going, paying for hosting and storage fees, transcribing old and new episodes, promoting and expanding the podcast, and more I'm sure I can't think of at the moment. So, let's bring out these honorary producers. And they are Will Arenz, Fahim Shirazi, James Zobar, Adam Bellows, Eric Phillips, Paul Appel, Julie Dupree, Thomas Benson, Emma P., Janet Hansen, Lawrence Taylor, Tristan Oliver, Marwan Marwan, and the Status Quo Podcast. Your contributions are wonderfully helpful to us. Thank you so much. However, if Patreon isn't your style, you can always contribute directly to us through PayPal at paypal.me/ForSonaHill. Or please check out our store on Spreadshirt.com. Make sure you check for promo codes before you order. And now, let's get back to the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's so important that you bring up the domestic terrorism and, of course, the misunderstanding that, you know, terrorism is linked just to non-state actors, just to overseas and particularly Muslim actors, when in fact, as you note, I mean, much of terrorism even still is domestic, is often white, and is in other cases is state-directed terrorism. And then, so Henry, yeah, you had some really interesting stuff that you want to talk about regarding the federal, that I think is like perfect to bring.
Yeah. So I apologize, Colleen, before we began, I didn't give you any little bit of background on me. I'm a former Army MP. I was in for 6 years and I worked for CID for 2 years as a drug investigator during that time. And then I was a reserve police officer when I got out. So I have a little bit of experience in some of these things. In examining what happened with Breonna Taylor, it got me to thinking about how law enforcement in general and in the military to a certain extent, but in terms of what actually happens on the domestic front, is a, you know, that violent responses are acceptable. That if you know, it, yes, it requires cops to do some more paperwork and other things like that, but there's never been an incentive for law enforcement to act in a nonviolent way to attempt to deal with offenders in a more nonviolent way. Which there was something that you mentioned in one of your letters to Robert Mueller about the Waco raid that, you know, violence is something that the feds, that the military, the cops of whatever jurisdiction can inject into a situation, but that doing so will generally make things worse. Again, bore out by what happened in Waco, along with what you've been talking about, the Bush administration response to 9/11 and Iraq and Afghanistan, to only mention a few. And for our current day, there's a lot of data that is talking about how very violent police responses to things, the murders of people, that it's actually being that the protesting is being driven by police violence, but most police officers aren't keen to be able to see it that way, despite the data. The ones that I'm thinking about right now, that the suspect in the murder of Vanessa Guillen at Fort Hood, that he was able to escape from his unit custody where they had him confined there at his barracks because CID chose to do a controlled phone call in pursuit of a confession with him, and it scared him. He ran, he pulled a gun on the local cops that found him, and he killed himself. Breonna Taylor dying in her apartment as a casualty of a search warrant, even though she wasn't the person they were after, and that the grand jury, it didn't indict anyone for her death, but they did indict an officer for shooting in the next apartment, which somehow met the right markers. I'm not sure about that one. The thing that I'm after here is that it, in your mind, how do we come into it preaching nonviolent responses for law enforcement? And this is, it's somewhat separate from, you know, police abolition or defunding the police, but that we know that police violence, state violence is its own means to an end. How do we change that?
Yeah, absolutely. Martin Luther King, great quote about violence begets violence, you know, and others have said the same thing. You're not really helping anything. I think the problem, maybe one of the root causes of some of this, these overreactions, is the machoism itself. Certainly Waco, part of it is it after a month of waiting out whatever his name was now, I forget his name, the head of Waco, it started to look in the press like the FBI was weak. You're waiting it out. Why don't you just go in and get him? And so then they came up with this thing about storming the compound. Now, after it backfires and the children are killed and stuff, then there's a reckoning. There's a reckoning that this was not the right approach, and that using more patients, even though you maybe some journalists were calling you weak or something, or you look like you were afraid. But that machoism was at play in the Waco fiasco. And then afterwards, they did wait out some other standoffs of different, I think some other, you know, white supremacy groups out, forget their names, but these groups that were anti-government out west, and they were, they didn't kill anyone. They were able to resolve it successfully. Hostage negotiators are able to, in standoffs, they're the ones usually with the cooler heads. And by the way, at Waco, the hostage negotiators were basically, they were arguing, don't do this. And the behavioral people were saying, don't do this, don't do this. But they were just outshouted by the SWAT guys. And so this was basically a tug of war between the SWAT guys, who, by the way, this is wannabe militarism. You know, we're SWAT guys. We're not going to have anybody saying we're weak waiting for a month. So if you look at Waco itself, and then you can look at all these other situations, Breonna Taylor, I don't hear this nearly enough, so I'm going to bring it up. I taught the last couple years of my career in teaching the constitutional law. No-knock warrants were really starting with the drug war. So in about maybe late 1990s, and into the early 2000s, the drug war was causing police to think they had to execute so-called no-knock warrants. And there were legal cases coming down. In fact, in one decision actually said, if you were not justified in doing the no-knock warrant, you would lose the evidence. And I think that later got overturned. So there were reasons for me to be teaching and basically, you know, telling the agents to use caution. They were executing a lot of search warrants with local police. And what they would do, the SWAT team, by the way, it would be usually the SWAT team, they would throw a flashbang grenade. So they were called flashbangs. And you would go to the doorway and throw this little flashbang grenade or whatever it was. And then you would try to rush in real quick. And you were you were dispensing with knock and announce. So the law was developing that you actually had to put that into your warrant, that you couldn't just use your own, say, oh, well, we just decided to do this. And I was in the law, the federal law was knock and announce. And I was telling people they had announced their identity and their purpose and their wait a few seconds. They had to wait a few seconds after they knocked and announced. That became a big issue in the last couple of years that I was teaching. And with the Breonna Taylor, that to me is the issue. The people that are protesting different police actions, along with, of course, chokeholds and things like that. That's one of the things they should really be asking for. They should be asking for a lot more scrutiny on no-knock warrants. And in fact, I think you can argue that they're not justified almost across the board. They used to say that they were they would be more safety, that it would help officer safety. And I think that's not true at all. I don't think they can justify that it increases officer safety to execute a no-knock. They said, well, they might destroy evidence inside. Well, maybe that is a little stronger argument. But I think that's the area. And again, the point here is that this machoism is a military wannabe mindset that always existed. For instance, in the FBI, when I went to the FBI Academy, it was set along military. They tried to emulate like being in a military academy. I mean, a lot of it was probably a little bit, what's the word, you know, false. You know, it wasn't all that. They make it up to be more militaristic than it actually was. We had to wear kind of like little uniforms and stuff, you know, whatever. They make it that way, but there was a reason for that. They were trying to make it more like we want to be, you know, we're like, you know, soldiers or something like that. And that was always the wrong. Going back to what the right approach to law enforcement is, and I know this sounds real silly, but that old Andy Griffith and Barney Fife show, if you watch a few of those episodes, you know, of course, it's trying to make you laugh, but there's a lot of truth in that show. The Barney Fife is the guy who panics, and, you know, Andy is always smart enough to hardly ever give him his bullet, because when he does give him his bullet, he ends up shooting, you know, down in the floor or the ceiling, and messing up. He constantly messes up because he panics and overreacts. And the cool, calm, collected, smart, decent human being, Andy Griffith, he was basically the model for community policing in Mayberry. Now, I know it's a silly sitcom, but that should be the model. And for a long time, community policing was always touted. The chiefs of police, the Sheriff's Association, they even at a certain point federally were able to overcome the racial stopped by while black, you know, there was a reason for it. Oh gosh, what's the name of that? Well, it was a racial policy whereby police were allowed more leniency in stopping black drivers. And they didn't even, you know, they never, until a law professor said, hey, you're not even getting the drugs this way by this kind of racial. So that was even overcome. That was overcome in about 2001. The feds put out a policy that you couldn't discriminate that way. So there were things that with the community policing that were fine for a while. They could have been a lot more amplified, and they could have been a lot more taught and whatever than they were. But unfortunately, I think this was all set back. That whole time where there was a little bit of this was set back after 9/11. Just in the FBI, for instance, the FBI used to hire what they called diverse people with diverse backgrounds. So there was a woman who was a mortician before she became an FBI. There was a guy I knew, he was a dentist. Certainly there were some historians. I worked with our profiler who was a history major. So they were trying to hire people with all kinds of diverse backgrounds in the hopes that this would kind of balance out and people would have different perspectives, et cetera. Well, after 9/11, I think they became much more of a sole focus on hiring people with military backgrounds. I saw in the last year, almost every new agent that would come in to our office, a new agent, would be a former captain, a former military officer, and especially intelligence, military intelligence. So they gravitated. And that was just one little thing where this whole sea change, once we're in perpetual war, it can't be contained and it can't be compartmentalized. It spreads. And in that, and this is one of the ways it morphed back and definitely affected. We always talk about the equipment. you know, the tanks and things like that that were given out to sheriff's offices and stuff. And, you know, they could drive around in their tank and look like they were playing military and stuff. So, and, which is true, some of that. But that's just one of many, many aspects of how policing became more and more militarized, and just the mindset itself that we're in a war. I worked in the war on drugs, the so-called war on drugs. And of course, we had the war on poverty. So I never believed that when you were calling it war, I always thought, well, that just means you work hard. You know, the war on poverty means you work harder to end poverty. The war on drugs meant you worked harder to stop drug trafficking. That's all I thought it meant until we got to this point where it really was taking the same tactics that are used in war zones and then saying we can use them, you know, locally, domestically here. And that's, you know, that's the sad truth. And so there's a lot of room for reform, and there's a lot of really good ideas. It's just political will. And so if people would start paying attention to some of these acts, some of them are policing experts, and they've written all kinds of things that would really make a difference and would improve policing so that you're protecting the public, as opposed to, you know, the many people in the public are afraid to call the police, especially if they have a son or a daughter who are mentally ill and, you know, could have an old family member who's threatening them. You know what? The mother or whatever, she's going to be afraid to call the police. I saw this, you know, several months ago, a mother was being threatened by her 16, 17 year old son. She called the police and the police came and shot him dead. So like, she's like, oh my gosh, I shouldn't have called the police. And so this is happening. Mental illness, by the way, is something that the FBI, the policing needs a lot more training on. Because again, you go right to the thing as well. Okay, he's got a weapon of some sort, or I spotted a weapon. I'm entitled to shoot the person. So this is there's a lot of good, very substantiated suggestions for police reform. I don't hear about a lot of them. I see them written in more academic papers and whatever, but I'm not hearing, of course, our corporate media. Our corporate media likes to dumb it down. They like to make it kind of a good versus evil. They like to make something simple. And there are some really good reforms that should be implemented, right? One of which is knocking it out. So they really need to scrutinize that.
I've been in discussing some of this stuff with some of my friends. I keep making the point that when officers might announce for doing a knock warrant, that who actually measures what the people inside the place heard? You know, is that actually a function of officers? You know, is like, wow, there's a bunch of construction noise, we're not going to hear these people. And that goes right into the anti-intellectualism you're talking about. And veterans these days, probably more so than ever, are very ignorant, and they think that they know more than they do. And there's a sense of, I've been to war, I know what this is really like. Nobody gets to tell me shit about whatever topic it happens to be.
Yep, I think so. And I think the Breonna Taylor case is a prime example of the people inside could not hear it. And, you know, you might hear a little noise on the outside. And in some cases, the police only waited seconds instead of like trying again to knock and announce and in a louder voice. You know, so they were basically planning for breaking a door down. You know, they have a battering ram and everything else, you know, a lot of times. So, I mean, this is an area. Have you heard anybody really talking much about this on your national news? Hardly at all. And I think that's one of the, you know, again, it's concrete. It's something that actually is fairly simple to change. Some jurisdictions, and again, the courts were already doing this, because the courts were seeing a lot of cases where poor innocent people were getting shot inside. Breonna Taylor is not the first person.
Oh,
you
no.
know, this
oh,
is
no, no,
this
no.
is resulting in a lot of problems. And some of them went to court. One of the other things, besides criminal accountability for really, truly wrongful rogue officer, which never, you're absolutely right. There's a great book, I'll just quickly mention. He was a former police, Minneapolis police trainer, Michael Quinn, Q-U-I-N-N, the author. He wrote a book, What Bad Cops Do and Good Cops Won't Tell You. The title was Walking with the Devil, What Bad Cops Do and Good Cops Won't Tell You. And it's an excellent book. Excellent. So on policing, I would encourage everyone to read this book. That my best ethical book I've ever read, I've ever seen. And he uses all true story examples. And so the rogues who got away with these things for years and years, and then, of course, people see that and they say, well, OK, I'd rather be judged by 12 than buried by, you know, six or something. That was always a little thing that was said. And so when there's no criminal accountability, the other thing is civil liability. Civil liability, I think, I've always thought this in my head, should have been made more direct on the individual officers. This would not be popular with unions. But because the civil liability would only mean that the city or the taxpayers were bailing out the department. And, you know, we had people that this was all the way back in, 25 years ago. They were just beating people up all the time, police officers. And one time they beat up a hockey, and this was in Minneapolis. He beat up a hockey, St. Thomas College student, hockey player, and he won $1 million. So he got beat up and he sued and he won $1 million. It came out of the city of Minneapolis pockets. Now, what does that do for an officer? It doesn't really do anything. The officer went on to be promoted and never had any trouble, you know, never had faced anything. So there are lots of mechanisms that are very common sense that could easily be tweaked and changed, and you would automatically get better and more. You're never going to get perfect, as you well know. We're all humans, and I do think you have to let in some leniency, because the job of policing is like walking with the devil. It is hard as heck, and it's especially hard in a situation where the public now is armed. Lots and lots of members of the public are armed. And we have, like you say, the white supremacists and the anti government, and the, you know, there are people that on both sides. And the guy who shot up the softball team, for instance, the Bernie Sanders supporter who shot up the Republican congressperson's softball team. It's across the board. But from a police standpoint, trying to do something in the midst of this is hard. And you're never going to be able to do it perfectly right. I do think police need some leniency on some of this. However, on the other hand, there are a whole bunch of good police reforms that have up till now just been ignored. And they've been ignored because there's not been enough political will.
I live in the Portland, Oregon area, and something that the people living here have been trying to deal with, trying to understand, but mostly it's just scared the shit out of them, was the deployment of DHS agents earlier in the summer. And I'm curious a bit about your overall thoughts on DHS as an agency. But more than that, I'd like to know your experience with this kind of thing, that when cops are sent other places and it isn't an obvious thing, they're not going to deal with a big crime scene, or, you know, that it's, they can just be kind of floaters. How do you think people should respond to that, to respond, how messed up it is in terms of people's rights and understanding who's arresting you or talking to you, all that stuff?
Just as a coincidence thing, when I testified to the Senate Judiciary on June 6th or 7th of 2002, and, you know, I Bush apparently had decided prior to that that he was going to form the Department of Homeland Security out of 23 other agencies, basically fuse them together so that he could say he was doing something. You know, it was kind of like shuffling the chairs on the deck of the Titanic, because it didn't really do anything, but sure. He fused these agencies together. So apparently that maybe a decision had already occurred. But the afternoon that I was to testify, and probably in order to take the headline off of, you know, this FBI agent says that 9/11 could have been prevented. Bush broke in that afternoon and said there will be a special announcement. And then a couple hours later, he announced he was forming Homeland Security. And there were quite a number of other writers that said, oh, look what the Bush administration did. They took Colleen Raleigh off the headlines there to announce this. So that's just background. I think that what you kind of alluded to is that sending people into a different area, inherently, it's the same problem with hiring police from outside of a city jurisdiction. It already is going in the opposite direction of community policing, because now they're coming into what, you know, this is not where we live. We don't care as much about that area. One great idea for police reform is that police should be hired from the area that they're working in, and not, for instance, working in an inner city, but living in a suburb. Well, you can magnify that even more with Department of Homeland Security sending in people from outside of its jurisdiction. On top of that, the Department of Home, the people that were coming to do this policing were people like Customs and ICE and this group actually tend to work on borders where they're not focusing on American citizens. They were focusing on migrants. And so already they're in a mindset of that these are quote unquote foreign people. And so that's just because of where they're working. And so, you know, thinking that, oh, now the protesters are like the migrants trying to come across the border. So a lot of those agencies that they were sending were of that mind. So, yes, I think that if you get into a real riot situation where arson and Molotov cocktails, frankly, I mean, when we're in that situation now, we're way past. We are way past where somebody should have done something that we shouldn't have gotten into the situation. We shouldn't be in a situation where we're practically on the verge of seeing riots and people using arson and Molotov cocktails and all the rest. We had to back that up a long ways before this and say, you know, peaceful protest should be allowed. You can't use violence. One of the ways that this got blurred together was also after 9/11, and I saw this firsthand because Minnesota passed something called the Minnesota Patriot Act. It was a police officer who was a senator in our Minnesota legislature who got it passed, and he called it the Minnesota Patriot Act. Guess what it did? It made terrorism not into just mere threats of hurting or killing, of course, or harming, a threat to human life, but it blurred it together with property damage. So in Minnesota, this law, with as little as $1,000 of property damage, which could have been mere graffiti. So you could have gone up to a building with a spray can and done $1,000 worth of damage. And under this Minnesota law, this again, the post 9/11, people not thinking, you would have been labeled a terrorist. And this actually, they tried to prosecute one group of kids for things like property damage that occurred in the lead up to the Republican National Convention here. And even the prosecutor eventually dismissed the charges under this really egregious Minnesota Patriot Act. Okay, it's an example of when you're blurred together things like property damage, there should be a clear line between property damage and some things like graffiti and all the rest, and actually hurting people. Fires are kind of problematic because there's, you know, most fires, unless it's in a dump or something where it's contained, they can be dangerous. So anytime you set a fire, that's actually a danger to human life. So it's kind of something that's a little bit problematic. But oftentimes you can see things as clear property damage that should not be treated at the same level as anyone who is shooting or doing or arson or other things like that, which would be a threat to human life. Again, I will just say, I don't want to go on here lecturing, because the problem is I don't hear any of this on the news. I don't hear any of these real issues being ferreted out. Maybe some professors are. I hope they are, and I hope they get the ear of some of the politicians. But I don't hear it being discussed in a public, sane, in an educated way. I hear this kind of dumbing down of the whole thing, you know, basically kind of turning it into war. Oh, the protesters versus the police. And that is the wrong way to approach this. You know, we should have our First Amendment rights. We should be able to exercise these peacefully. How the heck we got into, you know, the situation where we're in now, and maybe, by the way, may face even in an even worse way down the road. I hope not. But, you know, there's a lot of people that are very afraid we could. And it's been little by little. It's been over these last, you know, couple of decades that these things have eroded. And I think we have to go back to the root causes, right, you know, back way up to how this, all these things started.
Well, Colleen, I'm really glad that you brought up the media environment and these messages, because, you know, one of the things that's most interesting about this conversation, and I think we could do a series with you, Colleen, because seriously, I have 1,000 follow-on questions. And I think that the best way we're going to talk about some of these things is to do our best to get them into the more mainstream conversation. That's going to be a challenge. What you bring to this conversation, this podcast, and pretty much everything that I've ever read or seen you do is this holistic approach that you're talking about, this sort of sophisticated 360 analysis of how there is no abroad and domestic, that it's very much interlinked. And I think partly it's because you worked at the nexus of that, and partly because you've just taken so much time to educate yourself over the years. But what is difficult, I think, and what I kind of want to end the pod with today is breaking into the narrative. You know, when six corporations control 90% of American media, when the same talking heads are, you know, from the military or from the intelligence community, who probably should have been discredited 20 years ago or at least 15 years ago surrounding the Iraq War, you know, they still dominate the airwaves with their same sort of interventionist forever war at home and abroad message. Not touching on much of what we're discussing. And so that brings me to, you know, this Eisenhower Media Network, this EMN project, which is very much real. We are going to be launching after the election, maybe around Veterans Day, which I think would be great. We have to, of course, see what happens with this election and everything. But I'm going to just read a couple of things from, you know, our draft op plan that I haven't really ever read before on the air anywhere. And then just kind of ask you for, you know, as we close out, just a general take on why you wanted to sign on as a senior fellow and kind of honor us with that presence and what you hope that we can accomplish. One of the things that motivated this project was exactly what you brought up, that there are folks like us, you know, there's dozens, I mean, at the very least, who are trying to spread these messages. And yet there does seem, with the, you know, with the exception of an occasional op-ed that breaks into the LA Times or once in a while the New York Times, most of us stay just kind of one threshold below. And there's a degree of a silencing in much of the mainstream, and therefore it doesn't, you know, touch the public in the same way. So when we started talking about this project, Ben Cohen and I, at a brunch in New York City 3 years ago, when I was still in the Army, we discussed this. How do we focus, or at least link together in some vague way, these incredible voices that are providing independent, critical messages about American foreign and domestic policy? How do we get them working in the same direction and hopefully get them, you know, into the mainstream media? And so we talk about in our plan, you know, our draft plan, that our objective is to establish an organization of, and that is driven by, expert retired military, intelligence, and civilian national security officials, hoping then to place them in increasingly mainstream TV, radio, digital, print media, And I think that the main thing that is important about what EMN is trying to do, or what I think it is this one key fact, which is that presently there really isn't any comparable organization of like-minded, independent, and critical veterans, that being the key word, and it's not just military veterans, but national security veterans in general, kind of honing and focusing the existing energy and talent from a pretty passionate and diverse community. The idea being that our product, to the extent that it exists, is our senior fellows. It's the voices. It's the willingness to critique the systemic problems that we've been raising on this pod. So I was just hoping that you can give us a quick kind of closing on, you know, EMN, your interest and what you hope to contribute and what you think we could maybe accomplish as we move forward.
Well, one of the things that I was, you know, which made me enthusiastic about this group is not only the stature and the credibility and credentials of the group itself, of the different individuals, but the fact that I see this as fully nonpartisan, bipartisan, because this corporate media, like you say, these six, you know, they have served now through their, whatever you want to call it, I'll call it fake news, but, you know, they have, in a way, faked polarization. So they've got 95% of all Republicans watching Fox and 5% of independents or something that are watching. 95% are going to Fox to hear what, to confirm what they already think or believe. Same thing with MSNBC. 95% Democrats are going to MSNBC to have Rachel Maddow tell us that we have to go to war on Russia. So I see this as a bringing together, uniting on the issues. So the issues, the corporate media has so polarized America that when you do have somebody, even like yourself or whatever, and you're trying just to say something factual, you will immediately have both sides, you know, taking issue with you, both sides, because they're so polarized. They can't even see the truth. And so I'm enthused because I'm hoping that by hopefully getting into some more media and getting more public education going, that perhaps people will see that actually both sides have a lot of consensus. We don't want to have the police come and shoot up our house. Nobody wants that. We don't want to face going out to socialize at night and have people shooting shots into bars and whatever. We don't want that either. We don't want necessarily automatic weapons, everybody carrying AK-47s and stuff. There's a huge consensus amongst people. Now, we don't know that there's this consensus because we've all been, this is how the corporate media and the political establishment has controlled us. They have polarized us, and dangerously so. They have really dangerously polarized us. So I've been very happy. Eisenhower was a Republican who warned about the military-industrial complex. I'm really happy to talk on issues instead of as on this branding or whatever you political identity branding that mostly is fake, in my opinion. A lot of it is fake. I voted up until 2000, including for Bush. I just to disclose my terrible voting record here, terrible voting record. I voted for Bush because he was promising at the time, you know, non-intervention, whatever. So I voted mostly law and order type Republican up until 2000. Then, of course, I did not vote for Bush the second election. Then we get to Obama. And I thought, okay, he's promising difference or whatever. And I took that chance. I wasn't real excited, but I voted for Obama in 2008, only to be terribly disappointed, did not vote for his reelection. And so then I voted, and I haven't voted, to be honest, in the last two elections for a major party, because both parties now are so fully engaged in this militarism. And I don't really see a significant difference between the two. I know that's probably, that makes, there you go, polarization that makes both sides mad. And so I see this as a group that can speak on issues and principles and, you know, even ethics, as opposed to this ridiculous political polarization that is really obfuscating most of the, like I said, even with the police shootings, it's one of the reasons why we're not talking about good reforms and possible reforms and the real issues. We're talking on political, you know, points about it, which is completely wrong.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. And that's a great place for us to kind of wrap this, because I think one of the things people are going to notice about EMN is that, you know, we don't belong to the Biden campaign. We don't belong to the Trump campaign. We don't belong to whatever comes next. And we have already in our initial, you know, 12 apostles, right? We have folks who, if they can even be pinned down in a political sense, which is difficult because most of these folks are nonpartisan purposely, there's a lot of Republicans. There's a lot of libertarians. I mean, I think that if we went through, you know, I'd have to really look at the data and looked at our first 12, at least half of them spent most of their life voting as Republicans. So the idea is here, hey, look, we've got progressives, we've got libertarians, but what we really have is experts ready to talk about issues who really do put the country first as they see it, who really do focus on the intellectualism, the ethics, and the strategy beyond this, you know, like you said, this fabricated and synthetic two-party duopoly narrative. We're going to try to break outside of that a bit by talking about the issues and not aligning ourselves with any one thing. So while we're not talking about having a message and an editorial control, our discipline is our fellows and trust in them, and you're just one super great example of that. How we, you know, we don't belong to the two-party structure. We belong, if anything, to a broader consensus that you mentioned doesn't get mentioned, which is that most polled citizens are tired of a lot of these things. They just haven't heard it articulated in quite the same way. The message that's outside of that doesn't get there. And just one last point on it. I mean, I talk about this all the time. You've heard me say it probably, Colleen, like there is this budding and natural, so even just on the anti-war side, anti-war alliance between, you know, vaguely libertarian Republicans and vaguely progressive Democrats or whatever you want to call them. That's just always been there. I wouldn't say it's been working at cross purposes, but it's been sort of divided and cleaved, I would argue, at least partially purposefully, by so much of this kind of corporate mainstream media to keep us apart, to make us focus on these other polarizing issues that sort of veil the fact that there has always been more commonality between some of these same groups. And we don't have to hate each other, but we can speak to something bigger, something that frankly is a little bit of a grander systemic critique. And so anytime I talk about EMN, I'm certainly going to, the word systemic is going to be my buzzword, but the idea that we look at the bigger structures and not at individual candidates. And with that being said, what you bring to the table in terms of your expertise and just how strong you are on your feet and ability to talk about a range of issues is just absolutely why I invited you on to this pod, to EMN, and I just feel like we have so much more that we're going to be able to do together. And I just want to thank you for that and for the pod and just everything, because I just feel like this relationship is only going to go further.
Well, thanks again and looking forward.
Great. Well, thanks again. And listeners, we are going to have some more of the EMN fellows on coming on. Maybe we'll even bring back Larry or some of the other folks that have been on the pod before, but we're going to kind of do a run through. Colleen is only our first run through of the EMN fellows, spreading this message, and keep an eye out, because we're coming and we're definitely coming strong, nonpartisan and independent, and definitely systemic. So thanks for listening, and we will catch you guys with the next interview next week.
We're on Twitter at Fortress on a Hill, and also at Facebook.com/FortressOnAHill. You can find our main blog page and our full collection of episodes at www.FortressOnAHill.com. iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Patreon, Spotify, you name it, almost anywhere you listen, we're already waiting for you. And hey, we're always in the market for more Patreon supporters. Please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com. And if you're not into giving us a monthly payment, think about giving us a couple bucks on PayPal. The link is in the show notes. Skepticism is one's best armor. Never forget it. We'll see you next time.
And listen to my song. I hope you'll pay attention. I will know.